This is Michael Edward Miller for WUTC. Currently in theaters, The Founder stars Michael Keaton. He plays the man who grew McDonald's restaurants into a massive global franchise.
I know what you're thinking. How the heck does a 52-year-old, over-the-hill milkshake machine salesman build a fast food empire with 1,600 restaurants?
That's Keaton as McDonald's founder Ray Kroc. Today, I have a story about some of the vast fortune that Ray Kroc earned, how that fortune enabled a very idiosyncratic philanthropist to donate around $250 million to NPR. This is the story of Ray Kroc's wife, Joan. Because of their wealth, she was able to give billions away, supporting causes like AIDS treatment and much more. My guest today has written a book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. It was published in November of 2016. The author, Lisa Napoli, is a journalist who's written this first ever in-depth look into Joan Kroc's life. Lisa Napoli, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, gosh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The way I've heard this legend, and this seems to be a real legend among people in fundraising, people in development, is Joan Kroc picked up the phone, called PBS, nobody answered, so she hung up, called NPR, and somebody answered, and that's why she gave them the money. But I think that's a bit of an oversimplification. What is the real story there?
No, that's pretty much the real story.
Really?
Apparently, they were trying to give. So when Joan recognized that she was dying, she had to take stock of everything she had. And to simplify it immensely, as far as banking goes, she had this one giant bank account with $250 million in it. I think it was $230, but at the end, it then wound up being $250 with interest and all that. But so she had this money tucked away in one account, and she loved PBS because she was a dear friend of Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, and had supported him over the years. She loved NPR because she'd loved Kevin Close, who was the fellow who ran NPR for many years. And so she wanted to split the money between the two, and her people, you know, as many people as she had. She didn't have a big staff or anything like that, but she asked her folks to make an inquiry to PBS because she wanted to give them money. She'd given money in San Diego to what was a hybrid of NPR, public radio, and TV, which happens, of course, a lot in this country. And she wanted to give it to both places. And the PBS people just didn't return the calls, which is just, oh, my God. Can you imagine? And always, that's the lesson. I've learned many lessons writing this book. But always return everybody's calls. You never know. You already knew you should be nice to everybody. But now you really know that you should return every call.
But one of the interesting things you write about in the book is she was like a lot of people. She didn't really get the difference between PBS, NPR, and NPR member
right.
stations. And that's something, you know, I benefit from because people ask me, oh, what do you do at WUTC? And I say, I invented Downton Abbey, actually.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, the sad thing is that people wanted to paint her as the sophisticated zealot, you know, and we know from working in the medium that people love, and we love that they love public radio and public television so much. We love it. But Joan just loved the media generally. It wasn't anybody in particular. She did relate to these individual people who she'd met along the way involved with these places. And for her, that was what it was all about. She wanted to make sure that there was a free and open media. She wanted to support that. But she also, if she loved you and thought you were fantastic, she would give you money for what you were working on. And those are really also very interesting lessons to learn, right? You know, that in the end of the day, the cause is important, but the person behind the cause is important too. So, yeah, it's a fascinating thing to think about, and how it could have turned out differently had she not become ill when she did. She might have given the money, who knows where, how, when. One of those great mysteries of life, right?
And, well, just trying to get like a clear picture of kind of her personality, her temperament. She was, as you said, she was a billionaire who, if she liked you, she might give you money. If you were with a charity and she just heard about you, she might write off a huge check knowing nothing about you. But at the same time, like her employees, she demanded a lot of them. She fired people just for asking for raises.
Yes. Yeah, she's a paradox, as was Ray. She had this big heart. She was very compassionate, but she was very, very fiery. And, I mean, I just love the idea that she'd be sitting around, as she was once, watching Nightline and seeing a woman starting a clinic in the AIDS early era of the AIDS epidemic, or as she did in Tennessee, there was a little boy who couldn't go to school because of a balanced budget problem with the school district, and he needed a tutor because he had AIDS from hemophilia. He'd contracted AIDS. And basically, she read this story in the paper, and she was so outraged that this little boy wasn't going to be able to have his own tutor that she swooped in and balanced the books of the school district so that she could help the kid, and then flew him out on her private plane to throw out the first pitch at the San Diego Padres, the baseball team that she owned and inherited from her husband. So, you know, she's just a wildly living large kind of person. And I think, you know, we all love stories of people like that, especially when they're wealthy. Even if they are feisty and fiery, it's so exciting to see that they can do something good, you know? We need messages like that.
But at the same time, like, I think it says a chef, one of her chefs just asked for a raise and he was fired, or at least that was what was claimed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was prickly. She was prickly and she was compassionate. So it was a wacky mix. And Ray was more prickly than compassionate. He was not a loyal fellow to his people up until... You know, if he liked you and then you crossed him, he might off with your head and then come back. And she was apparently the same way. So it's interesting. I think that's what makes these folks so interesting, is that they weren't a linear, you know, do-gooding crowd, that they had nuance, which most of us have, right? I mean, most of us are like that.
Right, right. But their relationship itself, it sounded a little bit like when Harry met Sally, actually, in the sense that, like, they have this on-again, off-again thing throughout a period of years before they finally get together. What is kind of the story of their relationship getting together?
Well, they met when Ray was selling franchises. He was peddling them all around the Midwest and going wherever anybody placed an inquiry who seemed like a good possible franchisee. And Joan was playing the piano in a restaurant that he'd gone into, and to sell a franchise. That was her job. One of her jobs was entertaining the diners at this elegant restaurant. And he fell in love with her, her playing, her personality. He insisted on meeting her while he was there for this business meeting. And what do you know, her husband wound up being named the manager of the franchise that Ray sold that night to that restaurateur. And Joan's husband was so good at it that he got a big bonus and the right to open a franchise himself in Rapid City, South Dakota. And what do you know, the next thing, he and Joan were possibly going to run off, or did run off with each other. She pulled the cord and went back to her husband, and it took a while before she and Ray finally married. Ray divorced his first wife, married another woman. It's very soap opera-y, but in an interesting way. You know, I didn't intend to be tawdry. I didn't know this when I started researching it, but I basically am intrigued by the fact that they had such a long passion that they did finally get together, and that they stuck it out, even though it was a difficult relationship. And apparently the last couple of years of their life were their best, because they were both kind of mellower. Ray was ill. He was older. But they just had this long passion. And gosh, you know, who doesn't love a story like that?
Kind of trying to get at the core of their relationship. He was 26 years older than she was. He was fairly conservative, a pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind of guy. She was much more of a bleeding heart liberal type. What do you think was just at the core of their relationship? Because I'm sure some people would just say, well, he had a lot of money. She was young and hot. That must have been it.
A lot of people have said to me, who knew them both, you know, it's really easy to say that she just wanted the money. And then there are a lot of old McDonald's guys who I think really do believe that that was the case. But people who were really close to them say it wasn't quite so simple. It was much more complicated than that. I think there really was a long passion between them. And I think as ridiculous as this may sound, that it was fueled by their love of the piano. They loved music, both of them. When they first got married and bought a place in Chicago, the first thing they did was redecorate so that they could put a piano and an organ in the house that they, the condo that they purchased. They were really, really united by their music. And I think they really, there was a spark between them. It was hard for me as a biographer because you're not supposed to suppose or assume. You have to kind of deduce forensically around what evidence there is. And I really do think that it's not fair to say that she was just after his money. She really did love him. They had a complicated love. And that's, you know, unfortunately, often the case in our world, right?
Well, one of the things that I imagine had to put a strain on their marriage was his drinking. And she eventually started something called Operation Cork, which kind of took the AA idea of alcoholism being a disease rather than a moral weakness and helped popularize that. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to me that Joan, and telling, that Joan decided to stay married to Ray despite his drinking troubles and use a sliver of the money he'd apportioned for nonprofit, for charitable work, and dedicate a big portion of her life at that time to helping get people to understand that alcoholism was a serious problem, that it wasn't just people who were bums on Skid Row, which was kind of unfortunately the mythology of it then, that a well-to-do successful businessman could have a problem. It was just unthinkable then. And she dedicated her life to propagating the ideals of Al-Anon, which is built to help support the families of people who are drinkers. And she did it in a really inventive way by commissioning films and books and public service announcements from the best people she could find and pay at that time to do those things. So she used mass media in the same way that McDonald's used mass media, except she was using it to get the word out about this disease that deeply affected her. She did that with the help of McDonald's PR people who were kind of standing by watching and making sure she didn't out Ray.
Yeah.
You know, so she sort of had had supervision and guidance. She was not an educated person. She wasn't a media person, but she was passionate about this issue even before Betty Ford came out. And when Betty Ford did come out, anybody who's old enough to remember that remembers that that was a big deal for her to make the admission she did, that she had had an addiction problem, that she'd gone through rehab. And Joan was an early funder of Betty Ford's efforts because she was so moved by her disclosure of her struggle. So it was an interesting moment in time in history, all the while as McDonald's was, you know, at the top of its game. It was extremely controversial in the 70s because of its nutritional. People were looking at the nutritional values of the food. They were looking at the environmental impact of the styrofoam. But it was still making money and money and money. And Joan was pretty much behind the scenes doing this Operation Cork, which was so interesting to find out about in my research.
And in her own idiosyncratic way, she came up with this character called Corky, who was supposed to be the anti-drinking mascot. And I got the idea that people around her probably said, maybe that's not the best idea, but since she had the money, she could do it.
Yes, she was a bit imperious about those kinds of things, as you might imagine somebody with a lot of money would be. She was very married to this idea of the Corky, and apparently she had gold corks made for the women who worked for her to help solidify that this cork was the icon of the mascot of Operation Cork. I mean, the peace song is amazing too. She commissioned a peace song that was super, super, I guess saccharine is the best way to describe it, in the 80s to commemorate the anniversary of Hiroshima. And she had it recorded with school children and a country singer. And basically she had it pressed back in the day when you did that on record and sent to every radio station in the country.
Daddy, can I talk to you? She said, hold me in your chair. I heard about some things at school that kind of got me scared. So somewhere called Hiroshima, Daddy, a lot of people died. I saw the pictures all in school and it made me wanna cry. And Daddy, did you know, she said, it could happen anywhere. 'Cause lots of people got those bombs and no one seems to care. Well, I'm gonna write a letter, Dad. I'm not sure what I'll say, but maybe if it's good enough, they'll throw those bombs away. I'll write, dear world, I really love you, and I want to hold your hand. I know my...
This is the song Dear World, a song commissioned by Joan Kroc, the widow of McDonald's founder Ray Kroc. We're talking about Joan's philanthropy. My guest is Lisa Napoli, author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Napoli says even though Joan Kroc had some wacky ideas like this song, Kroc also did some amazing charitable work. This unconventional approach to philanthropy that she had, how much of that do you think was motivated by her own childhood, you know, growing up in Depression-era poverty?
I think it was definitely motivated by that, although somebody else in that era might not have been so free and compassionate with their money. Joan certainly was, and no one, even Joan's daughter, was able to tell me why exactly, where this, the roots of this came from. But I think she felt the sense of responsibility, and I think she felt the sense of, wow, I'm really incredibly fortunate. There's something I can do with this money, and a sense that she should do something meaningful with it. And she didn't do what is very conventional, which is keeping a foundation going. She inherited the money from her husband's foundation and eventually dissolved the foundation and decided to be very unorthodox about her giving, which says a lot about her. If she was looking to build a monument to herself, she would have kept that foundation going. She had advisors who advised her to do that. It was smart economically. It was just smart for the long haul, long after she was gone. But she was more passionate and just sort of frivolous is the wrong word, but she was just more inventive than that. And building a legacy to herself wasn't what her mission was. Of course, that's what's become the case, given that her name is said on public radio every day. But that wasn't in her gift to NPR, that she be remembered that way. Not at all. She wanted to be more under the radar than she actually was. I wonder a lot, you know, if she'd want to thump me over the head with this book I've written.
Yeah, well, that's one thing you actually say in the book, is that she probably wouldn't have wanted someone to write a book about her, which, I mean, she had to figure that being as famous and as wealthy and as influential as she was, people would want to know about her.
Right. And they did, you know, in the 70s and 80s, after Ray died, in San Diego in particular, I had a field day in the archives of the newspapers there, because there were tons of stories written about both of them. And then when he died, about her, she was starting this giving. And it was, you know, in response to a shooting in San Ysidro right near where she lived, she started a victims fund. And she just really responded to her community in a way that was incredible. But she still kept saying, don't let anybody write a book about me. All these people around her had this cone of silence around them. I think part of that was because, as you know, when you give money, people come out of the woodwork asking you for money. So I think she wanted to shield herself from that. But I think she also just really honestly, genuinely, as imperious as she could be with the staff, she really just didn't want to have to deal with publicity, somebody meddling in her personal life. There was a shame to having been with Ray before she married him that, you know, in our culture today is much different, right? In the age of reality,
yeah,
TV,
yeah,
where people do all kinds of crazy things. So I think that there was a different sort of social moray. She didn't want people to talk about that. She did talk about Ray's alcoholism after he died. He had been put into rehab at the end of his life, and she would mention it. But she was, you know, living by these rules of our society that were different then. And the book, I just hope, you know, up in the heavens. She says, wait, yeah, this woman down there was working on this book for 5 years because I really felt it was important for people to celebrate her philanthropy. Gates and Buffett are great. They give away so much money. They've done so much good. But before they made the commitment to give away all their money, she did too. And she didn't make a big blustering statement about it. She just happened to do it. I think that that's a message that's really, really important for our times, that, you know, there's only so much money you need to be happy. She was perfectly happy, and she was really happy in giving. And that's a message that, wow, I hope cascades around the world, right now especially.
We're just about out of time. What was the most surprising thing that you dug up about her when you were doing all this research?
I think the day I got the divorce records from the courthouse in Chicago and saw that he had a violent and ungovernable temper, I sat on the floor of my spare bedroom and just held my head in my hands as if it was somebody I knew. And I felt really deeply, deeply sorry that their relationship had deteriorated to that point and that she had to suffer that way. I was really moved to know that, and that she still stayed despite the difficulties, and fought back by starting this group. She had this air of selflessness about her, even though it went along with this, you know, strange streak she had too. So that complexity made me really relate to her. I'm a complex woman. We're all complicated people in our own way. And this is just such a fantastic thing to take this money from McDonald's, which is so reviled by so many and adored by others, and to use it the way she did. It just, gosh, it just consumed me. It still does.
That was Lisa Napoli, author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Right now, the movie The Founder is in theaters, starring Michael Keaton as Ray Kroc. This book doesn't have any official connection to that movie, but it does give you another perspective on Ray's life, and more specifically on Joan's life, and how she was so generous, yet so quirky, to say the least. You're listening to Around It About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller.